First, a mass shooting at two New Zealand mosques last week killed 50 people and left 50 injured. The shooting targeted Muslim immigrants and has again raised questions about social media outlets and their role in radicalization online. At a speech before New Zealand's parliament, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said social media companies need to start taking responsibility for content on their sites. Here's a listen.
We cannot simply sit back and accept that these platforms just exist and that what is said on them is not the responsibility of the place where they are published. They are the publisher, not just the postman.
Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
How does social media play into radicalization, whether we're talking about a white supremacist like the one apparently involved in this shooting or in, say, ISIS-inspired violence?
Well, you know, what is so interesting is how extremists have evolved using all kinds of media, going back to 100 years ago when the Klan relaunched on the Atlanta premiere of the first full-length motion picture, Birth of a Nation. Since then, obviously, we've had other forays. So in 1985, the first Aryan-based bulletin board, LibertyNet, started here in the United States. And then in 1995, we had Stormfront. And that was really something that enabled, as a spoke-in-a-wheel kind of relationship, to help white nationalists around the world connect. Since then, what has happened has been a more robust social media landscape, which has also become diversified and splintered during a time that nationalism has risen just when we've had sociopolitical fracturing. So we had three things, really: the evolution and fragmentation of social media. On top of that, we saw fragmentation within society, and these extremist groups can use that wedge to get in as a legitimate alternative to mainstream alternatives, particularly at a time when we've seen a five-decade decline in trust in the communal institutions that hold us together, like the courts, Congress, the media, academia, financial markets, etc.
Now, this has been called a shooting in some ways, not just inspired by, but designed for social media, live video streaming, the so-called manifesto posted on a website known for being one of the ugliest places on the internet. This is a case where someone was very much hoping to use this event and social media to advertise and maybe inspire others.
You know why I love doing your show? Because it's almost as if we rehearsed this in advance and we didn't. That was actually a point I was making for something I was writing independently. And that is, we not only, you're exactly spot on. We saw social media become something more than just a blank easel to more of a vehicle. And within the white nationalist movement in particular, there have been certain things that make it able to leverage social media more. One is their evolving relationship with the mainstream and how if they jettison some of their more horrific Nazi and Klan symbols and trade it for identitarianism or it's okay to be white or protect Western civilization, that's something that'll sell a little more. And when you have 9% of Americans, according to an ABC Washington Post poll from 2017, 9% saying Nazi views are acceptable, that is a decent swath. Furthermore, you have 14% in another poll, Reuters Ipsos, that said whites are under attack and people of color aren't. So in a fragmented socio-political landscape, we also have a fragmented social media landscape. And what that's allowed is the internet to ensnare a whole set of people around the world. And it's part of what they call propaganda of the deed. So in the past, you'd advertise someone else's violence. Now you're advertising your own. And indeed, the Norway shooter, whose name I don't want to give, was going to stream his attack over YouTube, but didn't. Now, each of them are leaving manifestos and mentioning prior extremist killers, in particular ones that have been from far-flung places like Norway or South Carolina. So indeed, what happens is social media is making icons out of terrorists who are then programming their attacks as delivery systems for not only manifestos, but for the violence itself, which is known as propaganda of the deed with respect to white nationalists and skinheads. Racist skinheads.
Talking to Brian Levin, professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino, about last week's shootings, terrorist shootings in New Zealand, and how ideologies and inspiration for violence are spread sometimes on social media. You mentioned saying the perpetrators' names. I want to go back to New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. She talked some about this issue. Here's a little of what she had to say.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety, and that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless.
Brian, can you talk about the value of not repeating the perpetrator's name?
Absolutely. And what we've seen as a phenomenon since Columbine, or the University of California Santa Barbara area attacks, and others, where these folks have become folk heroes in certain violent, unstable segments of digital media. And it is unfortunate, but one of the things that we have to understand is that social media is not only being manipulated by foreign actors, but by violent extremists among us. And that is going to be a new challenge. And we're seeing increasing calls across the world for some kind of regulation. I'm not saying that exactly what that may or should be, but that is what is now coming on to the landscape with respect to national security. On the other hand, we have to remember one thing. We've seen a migration of extremists away from traditional places like Facebook, although they're still on, to other alternatives like Gab and Telegram and the Russian Facebook known as VK. So what we end up doing is creating a conundrum. The more we push for enforcement, the more we'll be creating an echo chamber in an already sloped pull towards a more fragmented, affinity-based internet. And I don't just mean cats playing the piano. I mean some evil things, as well as one that deals with direct person-to-person communication. That's where we're going. And indeed, Facebook announced initiatives in their own website for that kind of non-public person-to-person communication. That's where we're going, a more splintered and fragmented world that is supplemented by a more splintered and polarized and fragmented internet.
We're talking to Brian Levin with the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. We're talking about how radicalization happens and the role of social media outlets and the news media after the mass shooting in New Zealand. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see from social media companies when it comes to racist or hateful content on their platforms, things that can verge on recruitment or incitement to violence? Is it something they should try to control? Or do you worry that could end up leading to a policing of political speech online? What do you want to see from how news outlets cover these events? And what do you want to see from political leaders reacting to shootings like this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about radicalization after the mass shooting in New Zealand, how it happens, how social media and the internet play a role in spreading it. Brian Levin is with us from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the way we in the news media cover these events? What about the tone in certain online communities? And do you think social media companies should intervene and stop different forms of hateful or racist speech? Where should companies draw the line? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brian, there's been some attention on YouTube, people saying the algorithms there kind of keep leaning people, nudging people toward more extreme things. So if you come on and watch a video that looks liberal, they might push you toward more radical liberal things. If you look at something that's conservative, they might push you toward more radical conservative things. That's what starts showing up in your feed. And sort of without noticing it, you're being drawn further and further to an extreme. What do you think about that?
Well, there is an actual historical example of this, and that is the Charleston church shooter who massacred 9 innocent parishioners at the Mother Emanuel Church in June of 2015. Initially did a search on black crime and was sent to the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a button-down hate group, but nonetheless one that U.S. Senator Trent Lott addressed some years ago. So what we see is kind of a funnel approach. And to the extent that there is some kind of random tilting that includes conspiracy or bigotry, we should try to make sure that at the very least, searchers know what they're getting, as well as having this tailored for a general audience that is probably not looking for what I would say is deceptive type of material. In other words, there was a website that purported to be a memorial to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, and it was put together by white supremacists. So in the same way that utilities have to make sure there's a routinization and standardization with the services they deliver, I think the same thing is true with regard to social media. I want to be careful here. I don't necessarily think that it should be done on the basis of content, but I do think, as the Supreme Court has found, regulating viewpoint is one thing, but time, place, manner, as well as truth in labeling is another, whether it's a cigarette pack or whether it's the internet. And I think there's a lot of mystery with regard to how searches work, how they can be in some way reformed to get a more accurate view of the most trustworthy information without having deceitful or bigoted people trying to skew or game the system.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andy is with us in Westby. Andy, hello.
Hey, how's it going, guys? Yeah, this is terrible, all these shootings and stuff. But, I mean, when push comes to shove, more people are killed by hammers and knives and automobiles than assault rifles. And in regards to, you know, who's gonna be the disseminator and decider of what is bigoted speech? Because as it stands now, the Southern Poverty Law Center labels people bigots. Who Gavin McInnes, for instance, who is just a goofy guy, comedian. He says provocative.
Wait, you're factually incorrect, though. You're factually incorrect. I don't mind you having an opinion, but I think even a rudimentary search with regard to Mr. McInnes talking about non-whites is easily found with a lot of the good journalists who cover him. So that's factually incorrect. I'm not going to get into a debate about whether the Southern Poverty Law Center labels something or not. But what I can tell you is, with regard to some of the groups that they pointed out, and you can go ask them, I don't work for them, but what I can tell you is that some of these groups, for instance, were founded by eugenicists and have at various times had contractors and people who posted things that said Latinos were intellectually inferior. And I think it's worthwhile to point that out. None of us, by the way, in this conversation talked anything about guns, But yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, assault weapons in the United States, or rifles overall, are responsible for deaths in the mid-hundreds. However, what we are seeing is a shift to greater and greater fatalities in mass shootings, such as Las Vegas. And that's something that I think should be on the table with regard to discussion. But I don't think any of us even brought up guns.
Andy brought up a point that a lot of people are looking at with the white supremacist online movement. The irony, the, oh, we're just joking, oh, you're overreacting, liberals, is often the exact language. And that's kind of a gray area, and people pointed that to that, in effect, as a recruitment tool. Do you have thoughts on that, Brian?
Well, look, here's the thing. Bottom line is, I think to the extent possible, we want to allow as many viewpoints into the marketplace of ideas. However, internet service providers have their own terms of service because they want to create a certain kind of climate for the people who inhabit their social media areas. And they have a right to enforce that. There are also many affinity-based, in other words, focusing on one type of either political movement or social exercise. That's where the internet is going. So I think, you know, whether or not it's right or wrong to regulate, you know, with terms of service, the internet is going to a more fragmented environment where affinity-based and person-to-person platforms are going to gain more and more share, just like we've seen with regard to cable television and satellite TV. So the bottom line is, I think as a community, and this is an important point, I'm not saying everything needs to be regulated either by contract or even by law. I'm pretty much a First Amendment person. But nevertheless, I think we can have leaders that are going to use verbiage that will encourage civic cohesion rather than dividing it. And I think two quick examples were President George Bush spoke 6 days after 9/11 about tolerance for Muslims. Hate crimes dropped by two-thirds the next day against Muslims and two-thirds in the next year. But when candidate Trump, 5 days after the San Bernardino terrorist attack, spoke, hate crimes against Muslims and Arabs increased above the already elevated number that we saw in the days after the terror attack. So it appears that particularly around conflictual or emotional events, the words of leaders can make a difference. And I think we should encourage all leaders to do so.
Talking to Brian Levitt from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, about social media, the media, and the mass shooting in New Zealand. Back to your calls now. Nathan is with us in Mukwonago. Nathan, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up how I kind of disconnected from social media over a year ago and gotten outside, lots of sun, and it's never made me happier, and maybe that's a piece of advice we should be giving people about how they can disconnect and talk to their neighbor and, you know, enjoy life around them instead of online.
Nathan, thanks for the call. Brian, do you think that just social media, there's something about it that's inherently negative where we'd all be happier without it?
No, because there are a lot of benefits. People are connecting. They are sharing actual information. Look, in the same way that drunk driving doesn't mean that we should eliminate driving, we should eliminate the drunks who drive from being able to harm others. And I think that's a lesson we can learn with regard to the information superhighway. But the bottom line is, I think we have to be very careful in our good intentions. And I think the first caller actually had a very good point. And that is, we should be able to discuss changes that are going on in society. We should be able to discuss political, social, moral, and cultural changes and how we feel about it. But what I do think that there is a certain coarseness that has developed along with the immediacy. And we know that on top of that, evil people like extremists and foreign governments are trying to use social media to divide us. Indeed, listen to this. This is really interesting. November 2016, election month, was the worst month since the first anniversary of 9/11, Jim Nolan of West Virginia University and I have found. The day after Election Day was the worst day going back to 2003. And guess what? The Russians tripled their racially divisive ad buys, according to USA Today and the House Democrats and the Homeland Security Committee, found that they tripled their racially divisive ad buys in the few months just before the election. I'm not saying that that necessarily caused it, but they were sophisticated enough to think that maybe they could influence things in some way, and there were millions of exposure to these kinds of phony websites that tried to divide people on issues like race, immigration, and police use of force.
Brian, in our last minute or so, stepping away from media, we've talked to you about different forms of terrorist violence, different causes of it. Are we as a nation, as a government, paying close enough attention to white supremacy as a source of terrorist violence?
No. And what's so interesting, in the minute I have left, our data has shown that homicides that are ideologically motivated by white nationalists have risen. Ideologically motivated homicides by violent Salafist jihadists have dropped to just one last year. Look, anyone who has an ideological beef is going to be able to commit a mass act of terrorism. It could be tomorrow, and it could be anyone, including someone who has a hybrid mix of idiosyncratic grievances. But the bottom line is, as far as movements that are out there, white nationalists are the most international, the most widely dispersed, among the most internet savvy. And when you look at some of the opinion polls, whether it's 9% of Americans saying Nazi views are acceptable, or far right, not conservative, but far right parties in Europe routinely polling in the double digits, as well as increased engagement on the internet. And as Andrew Thompson wrote in Rolling Stone about 4chan, increased use of these epithets on the darker corners of the net, what we're looking at is a more public engagement by white nationalists who will be across a spectrum ranging from over the top horrible symbols all the way to more muted, amorphous messages, but both are about preserving Western civilization from an invasion of foreigners, many of whom are non-Christian and people of color.
We'll leave it there for now. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
As always, thank you so much. Always enjoy it.
Brian Levin is a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. He's with us to talk about radicalization online after the mass shooting in New Zealand.